Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me? Can you hear me okay? Yeah? Okay. Good. Well, thank you again for deciding to join us. It's a really interesting experiment having our first Red Cedar Zen 7-day Rohatsu Seishin. In traditional days, at least the traditional days, once the Japanese switched from the lunar calendar to the solar calendar, December 1 through 8. Originally, the Japanese decided somehow, I don't know how, that the Buddha's enlightenment was on the morning of the 8th day of the 12th moon, but that would be different days on the Gregorian calendar, but then they decided to modernize. Yeah. So it's on December 8th for sure, just like Jesus was born on December 25th for sure. So interesting that we're doing this online. So thanks for trying that. Also, I wanted to mention, in case you didn't know yet, a Daikan here, our wonderful Tenkin, is being kind enough to offer us 10 minutes of Han music before each time we come back, and 10 minutes before the official Zazen start time, so like 9:50 as opposed to 10, or 6:50 as opposed to 7. So why don't we treat this like a Zen Sesshin and not like a Zoom meeting, and show up a little before the time so we can enjoy sitting together and listening to the music of the Han. It's such a blessing, you know. So, what to talk about during our talks? I'll be giving several talks. Chris, Shudo Chris will give several talks. Plan A is for Kanchi and Allison to give some talks. We're just waiting to see how her health is. So, Rohatsu, and actually, the word actually means something like 8:12, you know, 8th day, 12th month. Since it's all about the Buddha's awakening, we were talking about it, and we thought, well, we should talk about awakening, you know, we should talk about enlightenment. And that's kind of hard to talk about, being beyond words and all that. So, I was thinking about how Dogen really taught that it's a mistake to think about enlightenment or awakening as somehow separate from everything else, you know. That he came up with this idea where he experienced and really felt was really clear in his heart on this understanding, not just an idea. That enlightenment is, you know, not some special experience that you have later because of the accumulated power of your practice, which is a little bit like what the heroic story of the Buddha's awakening sounds like, you know. Practice hard all those years, tried these practices with these teachers and mastered them because he was such a prodigy, right? You know. But that didn't really get him all the way there. Tried the grueling ascetic practices, mastered those too, and there's those wonderful and frightening statues of the Buddha with like just his rib cage showing, you know, no body left practically, but that didn't get him there. And then finally landing on the just right practice, right, the middle way practice that got him there, which is an instructive story and a good story. But I think Dogen didn't really buy that story because of the way it sort of separates the effort from the enlightenment. That he really felt like practice and enlightenment were not two separate things, but not exactly one thing either. So there's this wonderful idea in Buddhist dialectics of not two. So practice and enlightenment are not two. They're not two different things. But it seems a little too simple to say they're one thing, because we do need to practice. So why would that be true? If practice and enlightenment were one thing. So, as you know, Dogen came up with this phrase, practice enlightenment, that we are Buddha nature, and it made me think of the wonderful little koan he quotes at the end of Genjo Koan, which we'll chant in the morning a few days from now. Talks about this idea of practice enlightenment, and yet we still need to practice. practice and enlightenment, not two, not one. So remember the story. Zen Master Baoche of Mount Mayu, so some great master, was fanning himself, you know, with a fan. A monk approached and said, "Master, the nature of wind is permanent. There's no place it doesn't reach. Why do you need to fan yourself?" Master replies, "Although you understand that the nature of wind is permanent, you do not understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere." "What's the meaning of its reaching everywhere?" asked the monk. The monks in these stories are very persistent, you know. The master just kept fanning himself. The monk bowed deeply. "Ah." And then Dogen comments on the story. He says, "The actualization of the Buddha Dharma, the vital path of its correct transmission, is like this." It's like this story. If you say you don't need to fan yourself because the nature of wind is permanent, because wind is everywhere, why would you need to fan yourself? Then you don't get it, right? You understand neither permanence nor the nature of wind. So here, of course, wind represents awakening, right? Represents enlightenment. And even though the wind is everywhere in all things, so enlightenment is everywhere in all things, and permanent here is an odd choice, right? Because we know everything's impermanent. But we usually what we're talking about when we say everything's impermanent is the vast realm of the conditioned, you know, where we hang out and do our thinking and talking, the realm of the conditioned. So permanent in the story points to the unconditioned, you know, beyond conditioning. And so the monk's right, you know. Enlightenment, the wind, the unconditioned, the permanent is everywhere. So why do we need to practice? Why do we need to fan ourselves? And of course, Dogen says, exactly, exactly. That's why you need to practice. So no simple answer there, right? We have to learn this for ourselves. Keep practicing, keep fanning ourselves. And of course, our suffering will remind us, even if our big heads try to talk ourselves into some philosophical position, right? You can sit around saying to yourself, "Oh, we're already enlightened," but if you're miserable and dissatisfied with this beautiful life you've been given, you realize, oh, maybe so, but I better practice. And I looked up the term, I've been meaning to do this for ages, I looked up the term Dogen coined, practice enlightenment. In Japanese, it's something like Shuso Ito, four characters. And the four characters mean study, verify, one suchness. Study, verify, one suchness. So it's a very active phrase, you know, study and verify, practice. And one is in there, you know. One is in there. There's a connection here. There's a oneness, even if it's not just oneness, to this suchness, to things just as they are, right? To the wind, to enlightenment. And the other thing that's interesting is the first character, study, also another synonym there is discipline, So this is a very vigorous, disciplined practice. You've probably noticed that. So anyway, I was thinking about all this, back to the Dharma talk topic. And I was thinking, well, that's good. We can talk about Zazen because there's some tangibility to Zazen. It's something that we are trying to do with our bodies and our minds and our hearts. So who knows what enlightenment is, but we can talk about Zazen. So I thought, well, maybe we go over the wonderful, one of Dogen's wonderful texts about Zazen, like Fukan Zazengi, that we'll chant tomorrow morning. Or maybe one of his lesser-known texts, like there's two different texts by Dogen called Zazengi, and we should study those sometime. But then I thought further, and I was inspired because I got to work with some of our priests the other day, and we were reviewing what the National Organization of Soto Zen Priests thinks that the priests should all understand and be able to do and study and be able to live, you know. There's a list of standards, you know. Do you know there's a national organization of Soto Zen priests? It's not a large organization. There's not that many of us. And anyway, on their list was to be sure to not just study Dogen, although there's a lot about Dogen on their list, but to not neglect the other famous Japanese Zen ancestor, founder, named Keizan. And we don't think much about Keizan because we're always studying Dogen, you know? And Keizan also wrote an important text on Zazen called Zazen Yojinki. Yojinki. And the title of that means something like using Zazen to remember the heart and mind, or practicing Zazen to remember the heart and mind. So I thought, well, maybe we should study that. That's where I landed. So Keizan is far from forgotten in Japanese Soto Zen. He's very important, because he's seen as the founder of the larger of the two headquarters temples of the Soto Zen school, Soto Shu. He's considered the founder of Sojiji in Yokohama on the edge of Kyoto, which is a great big place. It's like a college campus. The Buddha Hall, I think, is like in some way the largest Zen hall in the universe. It's made out of concrete, built in the 50s, I think. It has over 1,000 tatami mats inside. It's a great big place. And of course, to say that Keizan is the founder is kind of the usual religious enthusiasm. He really founded a whole different temple called Yokoji on the other side of Japan, but through various religious, historical enthusiasm, he's the founder of that. And Japanese Zen, the way it's organized, is a little bit like a pyramid scheme, where each temple has temples beneath it, and they have temples beneath them, and they have temples beneath them. And guess what you do? You make a donation to the temple above you. So there's these two ones at the top, Eiheiji, that we've all heard about probably, because that's what Dogen really did found on the Sea of Japan side of things, and Sojiji here by Tokyo on the other side of the country, other side of Honshu. So any Japanese Zen person in Japan would right away recognize Keizan, but we don't think that much about Keizan. So I thought we should give Keizan his due. Probably we don't think about it much because we're so sort of Western, and we think about texts and philosophy and the ideas of enlightenment. And Dogen was a prolific and important writer, as you know. Keizan, who was just two generations later, depending on how you count, he was born a little bit after Dogen passed away. He wrote plenty too, but I think philosophers and Buddhist studies scholars are less impressed, you know. He ain't Dogen. His most important work is a series of stories on the chain of succession from Buddha through all the Indian ancestors to Bodhidharma and through all the Chinese ancestors and all the way up to Dogen's first disciple named Ajo. And Ajo is Keizan's teacher's teacher. So it's a wonderful, enthusiastic book about stories and koans, basically about each ancestor, called Denko Ruku. And it represents also the wonderful mythology of Zen, you know, about ancestors that we got from the Chinese. And there's ancestral charts, you know, with these little lines going very tidily down to the next ancestor. Sometimes it branches if a teacher had a lot of disciples, it's a little branch like a family tree. Like family, you know. And although it's actually true that each of us in our biological family could only have one mother and father, it's not so true in real historical fact about Zen, but that's okay. It's a wonderful, enthusiastic idea. So that's Keizan's famous work. But he also wrote this important text about Zazen, so I thought we'd look at that. But a little more about Keizan himself, because he's a pretty cool guy, actually, so it's good to bring him forward, especially these days, because Keizan, in this very patriarchal world of Japanese and Chinese Zen and Buddhism in general. Sorry to say, being a male white teacher talking to you now, what you already know, you know, pretty male dominated throughout the centuries. Now, I think in American Zen, we have more or less the same number of male and female teachers. Not so good on other kinds of diversity, but, you know, we're trying. So what's cool about Keizan, in this dimension at least, is he was kind of like as close as you could get in medieval Japan to being a feminist. He was raised by his grandmother, and it turns out his eventual closeness to Dogen's lineage, membership in Dogen's lineage, was sort of like preordained, because his grandmother was in society in Kyoto, and she was one of Dogen's supporters when the young Dogen returned from China. And as an adult, Keizan was also very close to his mother, who was a Buddhist nun. Not ordained into the Soto Zen lineage, but a Buddhist nun. Which is maybe why she didn't raise him. I haven't found that out yet. Why was he raised by his grandmother if he was close to his mother? But his mother was also like his Dharma advisor. And as he got famous, his mother would show up periodically and kind of talk him down, you know. Help him stay humble, which he always appreciated. And he also helped his mother become appointed as an abbess of a small monastery, a place called Jojuji. And the other thing that's cool about Keizan as a feminist, or, you know, they didn't have that term, but apparently he really appreciated women, is the first person he gave Dharma transmission to was his female student, Ekyu, and that also was the first Dharma transmission given to any woman in Soto Zen ever, you know, in Japan. Apparently he also wanted a woman to be his Dharma heir, you know, for this lineage chart that we're gradually building generation after generation. But I don't know if it was by fault of his own, but it didn't work out that way. And so on your lineage chart, if you've received Chukai or priest ordination, you'll find a male name after Keizan Jokin Daisho. And the other thing that's really cool about Keizan, and maybe it goes with this kind of emphasis on the feminine in his life and practice, was that he really listened to dreams. I couldn't remember the stories, so I'll look them up for a future talk this week, hopefully, but he made several important life decisions based on what he remembered from his dreams. Experiences he had in his dream life. And that's a deep idea in practice, you know. We're so, sort of, in our Western materialism, we don't think about practicing in our dreams as much, but it's a deep idea in all practice traditions, I think. You can practice with and within your dreams. And he even had notable dreams where his grandmother showed up after she passed away, directing him, and he would listen, follow the guidance of his dream grandmother. Yeah, isn't that great? But the real reason why Keizan's important is why a Japanese Soto Zen person would, you know, of course, be very familiar with his life and who he was that Keizan was a sort of efficient organizer. So I think probably, I don't know if this, you know, but if the historians would agree perfectly, but probably if Keizan hadn't showed up, we would never be doing this. And we would never have heard of Dogen. Because Dogen was a kind of class, you know. Eiheiji, when Dogen died, was just two buildings, small place, I don't know how many monks, 40, 50, maybe at the most. And Dogen being a purist and a serious, serious guy, you know, he didn't run around popularizing anything, right? He just did his practice and gave his talks and wrote them down, or his student Eijo wrote them down. But Keizan knew how to organize, you know. So he founded several temples, and his students went on to found several temples. So the proliferation of Soto Zen was partly more through him than through Dogen. And also Keizan, you know, intelligently realized that they should dedicate merit of practice not just to bodhisattvas and Buddhas, but they should dedicate merit to secular officials too. especially like the local secular officials. So he was a little bit crafty, you know, too. So you can get some funding, you know. We think of Buddhism as so pure, and we had a lot of resistance at Red Cedar Zen back in the day when we started having members and getting involved in money and stuff, you know, but Kazon realized, yeah, you got to fund this somehow. So Buddhism over the centuries has always been a little bit elitist in that way. But at the same time, so here's Kazon's real genius. Same time he was effective in tapping into the regional elite and actually staying away from the national imperial elite, because that would have blown the thing away. He also was able to access the hearts of the farmers, you know, of the local people. And I'm pretty sure he was one of the innovators involved in doing Jukai ceremonies, you know, receiving the precepts and the Rakusu for non-monks, you know, for lay people. That was a Japanese innovation that he was involved in. I need to triple check my facts there, but I'm pretty sure he was one of the monks that helped start that. And a lot of the farmers, you know, were illiterate, you know, as poor farmers have been throughout history. And so receiving their lineage paper also had a real power, you know, the written word with their Dharma name and maybe their secular name on it. So that helps cement Soto Zen as the Zen of the masses, you know. Even so, the other kind of Buddhism that was emerging about the same time, Pure Land Buddhism, was way more popular, so. Don't let this get to our heads, you know. Zen's been a little fringy from the beginning. Who would want to do all this zazen anyway? So let's open our hearts a little to Master Kazon, you know. Sincere, promoter of woman, politically astute, but really caring about ordinary people, all at the same time. Amazing. So here's the opening paragraph of his text. Zazen Yojinki, using or practicing Zazen to remember the heart-mind. Okay, and I have all this electronically, so I'll try to send out the whole text at the end of retreat when you might want to look at it later. Kazon wrote, Zazen allows people to directly enlighten the primordial mind and to abide peacefully in their original state. This is known as realizing one's original face, or manifesting the true nature of the primordial mind. Zazen is the dropping off of body and mind and remaining detached, whether seated or lying down. It's not concerned with good or evil. It transcends the distinctions of worldly and sacred delusion and enlightenment, sentient beings and Buddhas. Let me reread that sentence. It transcends the distinctions of worldly and sacred delusion and enlightenment, sentient beings and Buddhas. It relinquishes the 10,000 things, renounces all conditions, casts aside everything, and does not rely on the six senses. So, Zazen as peace, right? Letting go. Beyond good and evil, transcending delusion and enlightenment. I'm really interested, there's kind of a four-up grid here implied, I think, where he says, worldly and sacred delusion and enlightenment. Maybe there's just a missing comma, but I like that as a four-up thing. Worldly and sacred delusion and enlightenment. So they're suggesting maybe that there's worldly delusion and sacred delusion. That's really worth contemplating. It's really cool, I think. We all know what worldly delusion is. But what might sacred delusion be? Sacred delusion. Norman's writing a lot lately about the pivotal importance of imagination. We just have been studying Norman's book on the six paramitas, and he talks mostly about imagination, you know. The importance of imagination in our practice. So I was thinking maybe that's what sacred delusion might be about. Maybe our incredible ability to imagine a more perfect, beautiful, peaceful world, you know, an enlightened self, a harmonious world. Maybe that's sacred delusion. It's not real, right? You know, so we're making this up, we're imagining this. But delusion, has a negative connotation all by itself, and maybe it shouldn't, Delusion itself sounds like worldly delusion, confused, wrong-headed ideas, being mixed up, greedy, self-focused, angry, missing the point. But maybe delusion is not just negative like that. Maybe there's sacred delusion, blissful vision. And maybe that's really important, Really important. And also this other two dimensions of this little 4x4 grid that I'm imputing in Dogen's work, or Kazan's work, sorry. Worldly and sacred delusion and enlightenment. So how about worldly and sacred enlightenment? Worldly enlightenment, sacred enlightenment, also interesting. Because Zen is so concerned with embracing the ordinary as sacred too, right? The worldly enlightenment of just being here in this planet, in this life as it is. So perhaps we're leading Z but perhaps, we're leaving Zazen behind a little bit here. Because Zazen transcends even these ideas, right? Beyond ideas. Wonderful to have more subtle and beautiful ideas about life than just being caught, in our day-to-day suffering. That's important. That's uplifting, right? We study. We have a bigger vision. But Zazen says go even further, right? Go beyond all ideas, beyond sacred, beyond worldly, beyond enlightenment, beyond delusion. And then Kazon repeats a Dogen phrase, dropping off body and mind. And this phrase, which is Shinjin Datsuraku in Japanese, is kind of a big deal. And it looks like Dogen kind of took a phrase he heard in China with his teacher and gave it some twists, as he always did. And I looked this up and I ran into this Buddhist studies article, like 10 pages long, about this phrase, dropping off body and mind, Shinjin Datsuraku. And some theories are maybe Dogen actually just misunderstood and made up his own meaning. And I don't know. I don't think we have to worry too much. But it's an important idea, important feeling to this idea, dropping off body and mind as Zazen. So maybe we could just think about it as fully letting go while being fully present. Dropping off body and mind. So let's play with that in Zazen, and in between Zazen, which is also still Zazen. What would letting go and being fully present be? Because letting go could sound a little bit like drifting off somewhere or going somewhere else. But feeling fully present could be a little bit like we're holding on to something, right? So letting go fully present. Or maybe sometimes in Zazen, a simpler phrase or words that point to something emerges. Like lately, what's been coming up for me during Zazen is on the in-breath, time to time, not all the time, but from time to time on the in-breath, what comes up is opening. Right? Opening. Ah. And on the out-breath, healing. Opening, healing. You can practice that if you like. Opening, healing. Fully present, letting go. All kinds of words could be helpful, But also remember that this is not a mind trip. Zazen is body-mind practice. So maybe Rohatsu and looking at Kazon's teaching on Zazen can encourage us to take a fresh look at posture. How is the body being practiced through? And posture sounds a little bit like this mechanical thing, like arrange it right, set it upright, but the body is not mechanical, right? The body is alive, living and changing all the time. So I've been looking a little bit about at posture, and I've been concerned and curious about the way I tend to hunch forward, and maybe most of us hunch forward at least a little bit. So I've been working with a yoga therapist. It's been interesting, just getting started. And her first suggestion I recommend. Let's see if I can. It's hard to show on Zoom. There we go. Which is this, the hunch forward posture has the arms kind of rolled in, you know? So here's what she just suggested. Try this right now. So keep your elbows at your sides and bring your arms out. Just rotate your arms out to the side and let your shoulders relax. Breathe, soften. And even like bring your arms back a little further and rotate the hands a little bit. So like you're holding a platter and there's a danger here that you're going to, that the stuff on the platter is going to fall off behind you. You feel that? Give it a little time. Breathe into it if there's tension and discomfort. You know, be gentle. Maybe you don't go all the way back. I can't quite go all the way back myself. And feeling how that encourages the upper arms to rotate out. Let the shoulders drop and the scapula come together. And the sternum lifts a little bit, right? Maybe the upper spine just gently rises up to support the lifted sternum. And if you stay with it, maybe you start to notice a little more space for the neck and head. And then the interesting thing is to see if you can establish something of that feeling. And then keep the upper arms rotated out as you drop your hands back to your lap and make your mudra. And you know, you'll lose it sooner or later if you're conditioned like my body from all this hunching forward looking at the screen or whatever, you know. I think it started in childhood, probably, though, before computers were invented. So there's an openness to the Zazen posture. And then the whole thing also needs to be planted, right? You need a basis. You need a support. So how is the pelvis on the cushion or the chair? You know, are you planted in a way that maybe the pelvis is tilted forward slightly? That's helpful. Maybe, and just checking out the whole upper body, you could rock it a little bit forward and back. Is it balanced? Sometimes our internal imagining of where up and down is, which is called proprioception in psychology and physiology, is a little off, you know? So let gravity tell you more than your head. I know it's because of this hunching forward thing, I'm so normalized to that what feels straight up and down is actually leaning forward a little bit. So maybe leaning back a little bit to my internal sense is actually vertical. And Dogen and Kaizen both, as we'll soon see, probably next talk, they care about this, you know, they bring it up. So this dropping off of body and mind, we do it through the body, you know, the upright, open body. And this idea we somehow got somewhere that the body and mind are separate systems, of course, is ridiculous. If you just think about it for a minute, if the mind is something to do with the brain, which it seems like it must, it doesn't seem like the brain fully explains the mind, but without the brain, no mind, right? And the brain is part of this massive nervous system. Of course that runs through the whole body, right? There's nervous system stuff everywhere. Do you know there's 100 million neurons in your gut? So the mind is everywhere in the body, and the body is the mind. So we're practicing Zazen with the body mind. That's what drops away. That's what can be fully present and fully letting go. And if that feels a little awkward, you know, so be gentle with yourself. Don't get too uptight, because there's a very easy fallacy here with all this kind of stuff of paying more attention to the posture, is that then you do another level of separation of the mind from the posture, and the mind is like the boss saying, get it together, Tim, sit properly, don't be a slouch, right? And then there's a lot of tension, and a lot of, you can really get upset at yourself, you know, so fully present and letting go, and letting go. So that's the first paragraph. Here it is again, at least my riff on it. Zazen allows people, us, to directly enlighten the primordial mind and abide peacefully in the original state. This is known as realizing one's original face or manifesting the true nature of the primordial mind. Zazen is the dropping off of body and mind and remaining detached, whether seated or lying down. It is not concerned with good or evil and transcends the distinctions of worldly and sacred delusion and enlightenment, sentient beings and Buddhas. It relinquishes the 10,000 things, renounces all conditions, casts aside everything, does not rely on the six senses. So a lot more one could say, but let's go on to the second paragraph so we have a sense of momentum. Kazan goes on to say, what is this that is nameless and cannot be identified with either body or mind? If you try to conceive of it, it is beyond thought. If you try to express it, words are exhausted. It appears both foolish and saintly. It is as high as the mountain and as deep as the ocean, yet discloses neither height nor depth. It is illuminatively unbound by conditions, displaying a radiance that cannot be discerned by the naked eye. It penetrates beyond thought and has clarity above the entanglements of speech. It transcends both heaven and earth and is realized only by the entire person. Not a whole lot to say. I'll just read it again. Because this is pointing to this is the counterpart point to the first paragraph, right? He said a bunch of words and now he's going to say, well, actually it's beyond words, right? What is this that is nameless and cannot be identified with body or mind? If you try to conceive of it, it's beyond thought. If you try to express it, words are exhausted. It appears both foolish and saintly. It is as high as the mountains and as deep as the ocean. Yet it discloses neither height nor depth. It is unbound by conditions, displaying a radiance that cannot be discerned by the naked eye. Penetrates beyond thought and has clarity above the entanglements of speech. It transcends both heaven and earth and is realized only by the entire person. Beyond the body mind, right? Beyond. Don't be limited by any idea. And of course, he's going to go on and give us lots more ideas. So this is typical Zen stuff, you know. But it's true, right? It's really true. Ideas are beyond ideas, you know. So let's just do the third paragraph, and that'll be plenty for today, I think. So here's the third paragraph, which is pretty interesting. It is like an immeasurably perfected person who has experienced the great death, parinirvana, and has an unobstructed vision and unhindered action. What dust defiles it? What obstacle can block it? Clear water originally has neither front nor back. Empty space is not bound by inside or outside. Zazen has a pristine clarity that is self-illuminating prior to distinctions of form and emptiness, subject and object. It's eternal but can never be named. The third patriarch, Senkan, referred to it as mind, and Nagarjuna referred to it as body. It manifests the form of Buddha nature and actualizes the body of all Buddhas. Like the full moon, it's without absence or excess. This mind is nothing other than Buddha. Self-illumination shines from the past and through the present, realizing the transformation and attaining the samadhi of all Buddhas. One more time, there's a lot there, isn't there? Sorry. This is also good Zen, you know, Dharma experience, you know, to play with original texts and be baffled by them, you know. So you just breathe with it, you know, you don't worry too much. Zazen is like an immeasurably perfected person who has experienced the great death of parinirvana and has unobstructed vision and unhindered action. What dust can defile it? What obstacles can block it? Clear water originally has neither front nor back. Empty space is not bound by inside or outside. Zazen has a pristine clarity that's self-illuminating. It is eternal, can never be named. The third patriarch, Senkan, referred to it as mind. Nagarjuna referred to it as body. It manifests the form of Buddha nature and actualizes the body of all Buddhas. Like the full moon, it's without absence or excess. This mind is nothing other than Buddha. Self-illumination shines from the past through the present, realizing the transformation, attaining the samadhi of all Buddhas. So now we're shining a light a little more on the person in the middle. It's subtle, but that's what he's doing. Well, who is this person, you know? Who is it that sits, right? What is it that sits? We have this idea, I sit Zazen. Who is this I, you know, in this ultimate powerful way that Zazen is revealing to us? Well, first he says, well, it's like somebody who's let go so completely they've died, you know? Let go into nirvana and passed on, not even holding on to the body. It's so peaceful that dust can't settle on you. You're clear like water. You're open like space. And that it's not something you do. So there's a powerful phrase in here. Zazen has a pristine clarity that is self-illuminating. Self-illuminating. And Dogen talked about similar stuff. You've heard about his self-fulfilling samadhi. Jijuyu Zanmai. So somehow Zazen does Zazen, right? Zazen takes care of itself. There's this idea of a person in the middle, but it's just an idea. And how do you look at it? So now we got to bring up some ancestors. That's essential. And it's a corrective for our foolish egotism that we think we're doing something. Actually, it's the ancestors that are practicing through us. We're just holding space for the ancestors' continuous practice, you know. So he names two ancestors in this passage. One is named Senkan and one is named Nagarjuna. And Senkan, he says, calls it mind, whatever this Zazen is, this Zazen person doing Zazen, calls it mind. Which is appropriate because Senkan is the author of that great Zen poem that starts out, "The great way is not difficult, just set aside picking and choosing." So that's another way of talking about how to sit Zazen, right? Zazen is not difficult. Just set aside picking and choosing. So picking and choosing what your body's like, what your mind's doing, you know. And and through all this, there's an easy-to-make mistake that messes us up big time. And it's the idea that this peacefulness, this nirvana they're talking about, that we're going to have a subjective experience necessarily. We may not, but that we're going to have a subjective experience of peacefulness, you know, that our mind's going to shut up and we're going to be able to say, oh, this is so nice. But that's egocentric, right? That's in the small self, you know. So this big self vision includes everything, including a busy, upset mind, a peaceful mind. You know, that's just the static, you know. This is deeper than that. So the great way is not difficult. Set aside picking and choosing. Let go of any of that kind of choice making. Because it's not about that, you know. So he says, Senkan, his famous poem called Faith in Mind, that's what that poem is, calls it mind, and Nagarjuna calls it body. But then the other thing that's critical here, I'll talk about Nagarjuna in a minute, but the other thing that's critical here is to not think like he's giving us a reference that we should look up, which I maybe sounded like we were doing, but to understand actually that Senkan and Nagarjuna and all the ancestors are right here, you know, right now. He talks about the present and the past in there too, right? We're practicing with them, they're practicing with us. We are practicing them, they are practicing us. Body and mind. So Nagarjuna is an Indian patriarch who kind of set the tone for Mahayana Buddhism for ever to come. Whether he really existed is confusing in the history. There might have been more than one individual, but it doesn't matter. There's Nagarjuna. So Nagarjuna is famously into emptiness. And his way of practicing with emptiness was using words. Using words. He pointed to meditations too, but he was a wordsmith of emptiness. So here's an example that's about the self. So this is about the self that's doing the Zazen sitting. Here's Nagarjuna. Just as it is known that an image of one's face is seen depending on a mirror, but does not really exist as a face. So the conception of I exists. I, like I, person, exists, dependent on body and mind, but like the image of a face, the I does not at all exist as its own reality. Just as known that an image of one's face is seen depending on the mirror, but does not really exist as a face, so the conception of I exists dependent on body and mind, but like the image of a face, this I does not exist as its own reality. So anyway, we have an image of ourselves on the mirror or in Zoom. It's a whole new Dharma mirror, you know. And we mistake the image for a real thing, you know. And it's the same thing with our sense of self. We mistake an experience, an image, a reflection for something with substantial reality. In the middle of all this, the moon, right? The moon shows up. The moon shows up, you know. Just like the full moon, without absence or excess. So sometimes enough philosophy, like just behold the moon. What's the feeling of seeing the moon? If you've been noticing the full moon these last few days, it's towards the end of the full moon. It's here in the early morning now, right? In the northwest. And that made me think about one time in my first ever Rohatsu Sesshin, 30-something years ago, I was sitting as a young man, bewildered, exhausted, tense, you know, oh my God, in the basement at San Francisco Zen Center. The Zendo was in the basement, there were like 100 people in there. I keep thinking of this old time lately. And there's these like these low, high windows, you know, like kind of transom windows that actually looked right out over the sidewalk on the street outside. And it must be that it was about this time of the moon cycle, when the moon was low in the sky in the early morning and showing through one of those windows. So I'll never forget Katagiri Roshi's voice, gravelly, accented voice, carrying through the Zendo while we're sitting away. And we weren't starting at 7, I think we started at 4:30 or 5. So we've been there a while. I hear this voice. Like full autumn moon. Like full autumn moon. I think that's all he said, you know. Like full autumn moon. So, like full winter moon. I guess he called it, I guess it is officially autumn, isn't it? For the solstice. Full autumn moon. It's here right now. I guess it must be only every so many years that the full moon is at the beginning of Rohatsu, huh? So we're sitting like the full autumn moon. Well, how about some poetry to clear the palate? Sorry about all those words. Here's a poem I just learned from the great Japanese poet Ikkyu, 1394 to 1481, so into the 15th century. He's the one that we quote him all the time. He's the one who wrote, "This world is just a dewdrop world, and yet," written at the grave of his daughter. Really sad poem, but beautiful, right? Beautiful. So here's a new one from Ikkyu, at least new to me. Perfect for the end of this kind of talk. Every day, priests minutely examine the Dharma and endlessly chant complicated sutras. Before doing that, though, they should learn how to read the love letters sent by the wind and rain, the snow and moon. Every day, priests minutely examine the Dharma and endlessly chant complicated sutras. Before doing that, though, they should learn how to read the love letters sent by the wind and rain, the snow and the moon. So let's listen to the love letters sent by the wind and rain, snow and the moon. We've had Rohatsu where it snowed too, so maybe we'll be so lucky this year. So that's our practice. Thank you very much.